But before, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here, and I'd like to review at least briefly the events of the First Civil War, as it's called, which raged between 1642 and 1646. Now, rage is maybe a bit of an exaggeration. The armies that fought in the English Civil War were really quite small by the standards of the 30 Years' War in Germany. It is hard to demonstrate clear social patterns of alignment, that is to say, either for Parliament or for the King, but it is pretty clear that about twice as many of the peers, the high lords of the kingdom, fought for the King, as opposed to the Parliament. At least at the outset, moreover, there was a rough kind of geographical division between the two sides. The King controlled northern England, the West, and Wales, whereas Parliament controlled the richer and more populous south and east of England. Parliament also controlled most of the seaports, which is crucial for the customs revenue that the seaports brought in, and also the larger towns. This was really an essential advantage, because through the seaports, and especially through London, Parliament could tap unrivaled sources of loans to ensure its financial survival. You'll recall the point made when reviewing earlier conflicts in early modern Europe that you cannot fight a war in early modern Europe on current revenue. You have to be able to borrow effectively, and if Parliament has dramatically more borrowing power than the monarchy, that gives it more staying power. And indeed, staying power is what counted. Charles did have important assets of his own. After all, he did have his own person, which provided prestige and an undivided source of command. Above all, Charles, among his aristocratic retainers, had an experienced officer corps, and had he been able to achieve some quick victories in 1642 or 1643, he might have won the war, in particular because his opponents, as we shall see later, were quite divided among themselves politically. They were divided among war parties, kind of peace parties that wanted to end this nonsense as quickly as possible, and an awful lot of people in the middle. But despite a few initial successes in 1642 and 43, Charles failed to achieve that quick victory, and this gave Parliament the time it needed to mobilize its superior material resources. What is revealing about these patterns of mobilization, Parliament's patterns of mobilization, is that despite the conviction of most members of Parliament that the war with the King was an effort to restore the ancient constitution, Parliament actually showed precious little regard for the ancient constitution in raising money. Parliament was quite convinced that strong times required strong measures, and impose far higher levels of taxation on the country than Charles himself ever had. So there's an enormous irony here. For example, that the tax that Parliament levied in 1642 was, in terms of its value, it brought in something like £400,000. It brought in about 50% of the value of all of the taxes levied in the entire decade of the 1620s by the English crown. Indeed, the irony goes even further, because assessments, as they were called, monthly tax assessments, which became the backbone of parliamentary finance, they were administered remarkably like ship money, that notorious tax that Charles had tried to impose, which aroused so much opposition. In fact, we know that in the region of Cheshire itself, the parliamentary taxes were actually based on the old ship money rolls, so that the taxes that Charles had tried to institute, which created so much opposition, were maximized in terms of their utility by the Parliament itself. Indeed, after 1643, Charles simply was never able to match Parliament's revenue. Parliament raised revenues through direct taxes, these assessments, also through excise taxes, modeled on what had been done in the Dutch Republic. Moreover, in 1643, Parliament was also able to exploit Scottish desires to see a Presbyterian-style church in England to conduct an alliance with the Scots, the so-called Solemn League and Covenant. And this alliance with Scotland brought in even more military aid, which played an important role in the parliamentary victory at Marston Moor in 1644, a battle which gave Parliament the control of northern England. In 1645, Parliament went further and reshaped its army into a national force, usually known as the New Model Army. This new model army would be commanded by men like Thomas Fairfax and Oliver Cromwell, who were chosen for their ability rather than their pedigree, and these men were determined to press the war to a successful conclusion. The new model army would, in 1645, crush Charles's army at the Battle of Naseby, and in the following year, realizing that further resistance was completely futile, Charles surrendered himself to the Scots, who promptly handed him over to the English Parliament. Now, one might be excused for thinking, at least at this point, that the political normality of some kind or another could now be restored. The lecture has shown how deeply Charles had alienated so much of the political nation and how decisively he had been defeated. As we shall see, however, the conflict between Crown, Parliament, and the political nation, and I would stress that it became a three-cornered conflict, was in fact about to get a lot worse.